Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and while I don't have a 16-year-old Swedish girl with me, I do have a no less opinionated editor, Simon Lambert, and assistant editor, Lee Boyce, in the studio, because today we're going green. We won't be gluing ourselves to trains or politicians' fences, don't worry about that. We will be doing something far more useful. We'll be giving you some useful tips and tricks that are good for the planet as well as your wallet. And we'll be also looking at why the hybrid car of choice, the Toyota Prius, isn't just for Uber drivers and eco-conscious celebs. Plus, we look at where the 40-something-year-old business owner with no pension should invest. We continue to puzzle over the baffling state pension top-up system and ask just how far over the limit can you drive in your area before being issued with a ticket. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
But first, the media has been saturated in the last couple of weeks by the green movement. First, we had Extinction Rebellion causing chaos in the capital. And then Greta Thunberg, the Swedish schoolgirl climate activist, gives lectures to our MPs. But what's been lacking is perhaps some good practical guidance about what we could all do to help the environment. So without fuss, the This Is Money team have done it for us. How to save the planet and, of course, your cash. But firstly, Simon, fresh from a holiday, which is, I'm sure, was totally carbon neutral, what have you made of all the climate stuff going on? Are they right? Is the government dragging its heels?
Well, actually, funnily enough, just before I went away, I think the final podcast I recorded before I went away, or one of the final ones, we were talking about investing to help the environment and the things that we could do as consumers to put pressure on businesses and why being eco-friendly, didn't have to be an anti-capitalist, that actually you could put your money to good use, you could put your consumer pressure to good use, and that also you don't even really need to necessarily believe in climate change to care about the planet that we live on. I mean, I'm sure that even those people who say that they don't believe in man-made climate change could probably agree that we might be belching a bit too much pollutants into the air and using a bit too much plastic and not being very careful about where we chuck things. And in fact, actually, when I wrote that column, I was going to mention Extinction Rebellion in it because I'd seen a sticker posted down on the wall by the station near where I live. And I thought, I wonder what that is. Not many people had heard about this at the time, these planned strikes. And then I cut it out for reasons of space. And now, in one of those, you know, I'm the mug who says this after the event, I think, oh, I wish I'd left that in there because it really kicked off while I was away on my, unfortunately, not carbon neutral holiday to the Alps. I do think that perhaps there is a point to this. I do think that one of the issues that I talked about there has actually come to the head in that people still perceive the climate change environmental issue as a left-wing anti-capitalist thing. And I think that if you really want to get people on board, you need to get rid of that so that the ordinary person in the street goes, oh, it's just jobless layabouts trying to disrupt my life as I have to go to work and things like that. You know, this is actually the future of our planet and this actually matters. Extinction Rebellion is built on this premise that society as we know it is stuffed, that we cannot continue living in the way that we are living, and at some point we're going to have to fess up to that. The crunch point will come. And that we can't really do anything to continue living as we're living. And we need to change the way that we are behaving and change the way we're acting in order to mitigate what's going to come. I'm not sure how many of the people protesting completely buy into that. I, for one, personally hope that climate change is a hoax, because then it means that actually it won't be so bad for my children, grandchildren, their children's generation. In the meantime, I do think that we probably need to do more about it. We discussed ways to invest for it, and now we have 20 little changes that you could make that will also save you money,
which we will go into in more detail. But Lee, we also had this week, didn't we, Mark Carney again, Governor of the Bank of England, soon not to be, coming out and saying that the finance industry, businesses need to do more. Again, it's that capitalism. Can capitalism work in favour of trying to sort out the environment when some of these protesters are very much against capitalism, not all of them? I also think Extinction Rebellion, yeah, clues in the title, sounds like a sort of dystopian Margaret Atwood novel, doesn't it?
Actually, just before you say that, there was a really good interview with the woman behind this in the Times over the weekend, in the Times magazine. And actually, she made the point that she comes from a left-wing background. In fact, Extinction Rebellion grew out of some kind of left-wing group. But she made the point that it shouldn't just be a them and us thing, that it shouldn't just be a left-wing thing. She said if conservatives want to get involved, if businesses want to get involved, if the money people want to get involved, she said get them involved because it's the only way that it's going to make a difference. And you only have to look at plastic bags. Mm-hmm. People said it would be impossible to bring in a plastic bag tax in this country, and it's been a massive success, and pretty much most of the population is behind it. So sorry to interrupt there.
Not at all, yeah. But isn't that, I mean, that's a good point, because as much as people are calling on businesses, on the government, we live in the society that we live in, and it's so easy, isn't it, to get a paper cup and a plastic bag and all that, and actually there needs to be movement at our level, your level, Lee, my level.
Well, change begins with one consumer at a time, doesn't it? And it's very difficult. I think what a lot of people start to think is that, oh, you know, it's just me. What difference could just me or my household, what difference does that make on a whole global scale? But if everyone started to think along the lines of, well, actually, a whole village, a whole town, a whole city, a whole country starts to change their habits, then we will start to see, you know, environmental impacts on the way that we live perhaps be reduced somewhat. I think, you know, plastic bag tax really has been the best example of this. Our use of plastic in the last 30, 40, 50 years has grown absolutely massively. Everything is made out of plastic, from children's toys to packaging, useless packaging for fruit, you know, packaged bananas in plastic bags. They have their own natural skin. They don't need a plastic bag. You know, it's all those sorts of things. We just have such a throwaway culture. But I think one of the big issues around all of this climate change stuff is that, you know, we're a population of, what, 65 million. I think, again, a lot of people think about countries like India and China, where we're talking of populations of a billion plus, and where we, you know, one of the first countries to go through the Industrial Revolution, and we've slowly tried to make things cleaner as time's gone on. There are a lot of countries that are behind that scale and are using dirtier, you know, technology to make things. And then it all comes about, and it starts to blow my mind a little bit when you start thinking about it in a roundabout way, because how many goods now do we look at, and especially in the last 30 years, made in China? And we're used to paying rock-bottom prices because goods are being made out in China for far less than they could be made here, because they are using those old kind of technologies. So it's kind of, it's difficult, and change begins within us, and it begins within whether we want to start becoming more ethical. And I think in the last 2 years, I would say, there's been a real trend for consumer products to become more, start buying these clothes and then you're throwing them away. I'm finding that actually there's a lot of people that like to, you know, just pass clothes around and buy more ethical clothes, and actually buy slightly more expensive clothes rather than just stuff you're going to get them throw away, and it just ends up somewhere, you know, not disappearing off the planet, and we're just slowly stacking up stuff on the planet. So I don't know, it's hard, and as I say, change begins within us. And you said earlier about Mark Carney, and of course he's not going to be around for too much longer as the governor of the Bank of England, but his point was, and I think it was a letter that he'd written with the French equivalent governor out there, where they were saying that I think the reason they put this out a little bit is because a lot of these activists, for example, glued themselves to the London Stock Exchange, for example. They see the money men as one of the biggest parts of the problem. So what Simon said there about, well, actually, you probably need to get this money involved to help shift change. He was saying, you know, things, for example, financial firms should take note. A good example of this is climate change creating more serious events around the world, more catastrophic events, hurricanes, for example, or flooding and all that sort of stuff, is then becomes a bigger insurance risk. And then they're having to fork out more money to pay out for these insurance risks. How many times do you think somewhere like New Orleans, I mean, the whole city was pretty much wiped out from huge flooding from a hurricane. So I think what they're trying to say in this is that they need to start thinking of the bigger picture. And even just to walk down to the studio this morning, Georgie, I was looking at some posters on the tube, Dettol, the cleaning products, they're now doing refillable products. So instead of keep going and buying another plastic bottle of antibacterial cleaner that you buy, you can now buy a pouch to refill your other plastic. There's lots of little changes, I think, that are coming. And I think consumer trends are finally starting to shift towards that kind of thinking ahead. It's got more in the psyche. I think it all boils down from Blue Planet 2. You know, even a couple of years ago, yeah. I think that really changed people's opinions.
Help. Media helps.
It does, you know, and visually seeing, you know, animals and things in distress, it plays in a part of the human psyche in which we go, are we trashing the planet? Are we creating all these issues? Are all these creatures going to go extinct? And we, I don't know, I think it's that sort of thing. People start to shift consumer habits, and then businesses stand up and take notice, and then hopefully more business stand up and take notice, and then boom. But yeah. One thing I will say about this Extinction Rebellion, though, is I don't think that they're doing themselves many favours with some people. You know, like, for example, gluing themselves to, you know, the DLR. I mean, that's a pretty clean way to get around the city, and London is blessed with a pretty clean transport system. What, you just want to push more people to get into the car and drive around? You know?
I guess it's got us talking, though, hasn't it?
It has got us talking, and like, something has to be done to make a splash, but I don't know if that's the right way to go about it. And then something like threatening to shut down Heathrow. You know, people, okay, you can argue that flying, you know, it's not a great carbon footprint, but, you know, people have got honeymoons to go on to. They've got family around the world that they want to go and visit, and disrupting their plans doesn't really appeal to me. It doesn't make me go, oh, look at those great climate activists ruining people's lives.
No, of course, but as I said, one, we're talking about it, and two, there are whole-scale changes that this group want. I mean, we're going to give some tips and tricks that we can do as individuals, and I'm pretty confident that a lot of the people of part of that Extinction Rebellion won't think that goes nearly far enough. I mean, we're talking here about, you know, only flying in emergency situations, getting rid of our cars, only having plant-based diets, getting rid of every boiler. I mean, this is huge changes, Simon, that they're wanting in a very short amount of time.
Yes, they are. And I think some of them are absolute in that way. And some of them, I think the ones with a bit more sense, put forward these changes in a less absolute way. So they'll say, look, realistically, you are going to fly, but just try to keep it to a minimum. Realistically, you're probably going to eat meat. Could you eat meat one less day a week? Or can you try to buy meat from sources where it's not as bad for the environment? Because the way the world produces meat is bad for the environment. But there are ways, obviously, of, you know, buying meat and eating meat that's good for the environment. So one of the best meats that you can eat for the environment is goat.
Is that right?
Yes, goat. They have a very low carbon footprint. And goat meat is great. So, yeah, I think that it's all very well making these claims in absolute terms and setting yourself a really tough target. This thing of going carbon neutral by 2025, isn't it? I mean, people have said that is just literally impossible. But set yourself a tough target and then try and meet it. And it is true that Britain has been very successful in bringing down our carbon emissions, more successful than most countries. However, there is also an element of truth in one of the criticisms that has been levelled, is that, yes, but we've also just outsourced a lot of our carbon production to other countries. But I also think that it's really important not to buy into this line of, well, there's no point us doing anything, because look at what China's doing. There's no point us doing anything. Look at what India's doing.
And America.
Look at what America's doing.
The president doesn't even believe in climate change.
No, he doesn't. But that'll change. They will have another president at some point, and the next president is probably more likely to believe that human-made climate change is an issue. Again, as I said, you don't necessarily need to even think that human-made climate change is an issue. It might just be human-exacerbated climate change. You think it's not as bad as it's thought. Or you might just think that actually, well, do you know what? It's probably just a good idea not to make a really big mess of the place anyway.
Yeah. Kill all it's just
general, like, looking after where you live. You know, don't trash your own house kind of thing. And also don't underestimate what countries like China can manage to do in relatively short spaces of time, because they do have a command economy. And there is actually a very big push in China, for example, to clean up air pollution in the cities. And China is making the kind of push towards electric cars that the Western world could only dream of.
Yeah.
I would fully expect all of a sudden China to just suddenly race past the rest of the West when it comes to the adoption of electric cars at some point in the next 5 years or so.
Has everybody here, just want to ask, has everybody here noticed that they personally have changed their attitude towards it? Because I know I have. Whenever I go into Starbucks now or any sort of coffee shop, if I have to get a paper cup, I'll feel a little bit guilty about it. And it's very rare that I do anymore. I'll always have a bag on me.
I've always been a bit of a stickler for not throwing things away. I hate throwing things away. I've always been a bit of a stickler for recycling things. I've always found it very galling in this country that our recycling system appears to be so haphazard. I think if you encourage people to do it, then they do. I really dislike getting plastic bags, but, you know, quite often I don't have a bag on you.
Have you got better recently, do you think?
I have. I rarely buy coffee from coffee shops anyway, so I don't carry around a reusable cup. But I have definitely paid more attention to it recently, but I've always paid quite a lot of attention to it. But maybe it's some of the bigger things that you need to act on. But it is true, as Lee said, that if lots of people just do these smaller things, all of a sudden it starts to make a big difference.
Lee?
Yeah, I've definitely changed a few habits, I would say, in the last couple of years, Georgie. I definitely now, when I go to a supermarket, one of the first things that, you know, part of what I would do is, if we've got plastic bags in the car, let's make sure we've got reusable bags in the car, because I just begrudge paying 5p. And this whole movement towards charging for paper bags, don't get me started on that. That really, really gets my goat. But, you know, the plastic bag tax makes a lot of sense. And definitely, again, with you with the coffee shop thing, you know, I do feel guilty if I haven't got my reusable cup with me and then, you know, get that plastic bit at the top. And we're seeing all these movements again. It's consumer change, isn't it, where like a lot of coffee shops are now offering discounts if you bring your own cup and all that sort of thing. I wouldn't say it's huge. I would say, a bit like Simon, I've always kind of in the back of my mind, you know, try and be as good as I possibly can. But I definitely think in the last couple of years I've got a bit better with recycling, for example.
I think also with the recycling, my beef with that is we rely too much. Recycling is great, but it is not the answer. That in and of itself causes issues. To have this mindset that, oh, it's fine, we can just recycle, rather than use less. And actually, what's interesting is in your article, one of the top tips you have is don't use shower gel, use soap. And that's something I'm a recent convert to. I mean, why was I using these bottles? What did I think that these plastic... Oh, it's fine, I'll just stick it in the recycling. But lots of them you can't. I mean, only something like 4% of coffee cups you can actually recycle. But because in my brain I think, oh, well, it's sort of paper, right? I can just chuck it in and that's fine. So what are some of the other tips there, Lee?
Well, actually, George, I've picked some of the ones that I would say that I do and I've either started doing or was doing before. So it's all pretty common sense. I'm not going to say that this is 20 tips that can completely change your life, and it's probably what a lot of sensible people are doing anyway. But one of the big ones, the one that gets my goat quite a lot, and I've got friends and family that do this, not being a stickler for the best before dates on food. So we throw away £700 a year households on average of food that just because it goes beyond the best before date, and we throw it out. Now, we don't ever do that in our household. My partner and I will literally eat things a couple of weeks. You know, it's just no, but it's just depending on what it is. Like, I'm not going to sit here and
meat products,
fish, you know. It's just about giving it a bit of a sniff test, isn't it? And knowing what's right and what's wrong and what kind of lasts longer, making sure your fridge is on the right setting and that it's cold enough. And it sounds like boring stuff, but at the end of the day, it just enables you not to... We've got one family member, goes one day over...
Just
throws it out.
I'm going to name her. My sister's terrible.
That's just what the supermarket, you know, should be displaying it.
Aren't they? To be fair to the supermarkets, they are trying to move away from that.
I have a friend who I once witnessed go into his mother at his mum's house. Bear in mind, this was as an adult, probably in his early 30s, to ask her if the bacon was all right to eat because the bacon's best before date was the next day. He'd already asked me about it. He said, do you think this bacon's all right? I said, well, what's the date on it? He said, tomorrow. I said, well, of course it's all right.
Yeah.
I said, also, it's bacon. Bacon is just generally all right. You can definitely eat bacon beyond the best before date. Bacon is essentially cured.
Exactly. You know? And how did anyone know?
The reason why they cured it is is before they had fridges. But he still didn't believe me. He still had to go in and ask his mum. I've also seen him question milk that doesn't have a best before date for another 2 days. So some people are overly cautious on these
things. But then you have someone like my dad who just never lets it go. I threw out some cinnamon or something from 2007.
That'll never go off.
It's 2000. That's 12 years old.
That's good. That's just matured like a fine whiskey.
If nothing else, if nothing else, though, he doesn't need it because it's been there for 12 years.
He must have been eating that very slowly, like one grain at a time.
But of course, when he needs it, is that cinnamon?
Exactly. Oh, I think we're all good with that. I remember cleaning out my mum's house when she moved house a couple of years ago, and there were tins of food at the back of the cupboard that were Safeway. And I mean, Safeway did disappear quite a while ago. I was tempted to stick it on eBay. There would have been some people that would have bought that.
Oh, absolutely. It's a collector's item. That's retro, that is. I have to say, one of the best things I bought was a soup maker. I got laughed at when I bought this soup maker, but it means
Do you mean a saucepan?
No. Yeah, all right, Lee. Whatever. No, it was a soup maker.
A blender.
Well, yes, it's a soup maker blender combo. Look, you laugh, but it means I never throw away any veg. I just chuck it all in.
Yeah, that's good. My mum does that a lot, actually. Chucks all old veg into a big pot with some chopped tomatoes and makes soup. Yeah, that's a real thing she does. That's a real mum thing.
Yeah, If I use a blender, it goes everywhere.
Yeah.
You know,
I got you.
And then I have to use spray, and that's not good for the environment either.
Here are some other things. We've talked about plastic bags. I think a lot of people are doing that now. And actually, it can save you a bit of money over the course of the year, mm-hmm. as well. And it's obviously good for the environment. One that I used to do, and then I stopped, and now I'm back doing again, is the local library. Now you think, well, that's a bit of a strange one environmentally, but it's, you know, it stops so many books being produced and trees being cut down. Also saves you money, of course, depending on where you live, because a lot of local libraries are getting closed down.
Audible, that's not a good one.
That's true.
Big fan of that.
Growing herbs. I absolutely love being growing herbs. In the last couple of years, our mint plant and our rosemary this year, I've got loads. I could start up a business.
What a good idea.
It's looking great. Those mojitos, Georgia, they need lots of mint. So, you know, that's good.
How long does it take to grow the mint?
Summer? Oh, honestly, you just buy a mint plant, it lasts ages. Okay. It's so hardy. You know, even the biggest novice gardener like me can keep that alive with minimal effort.
Great.
Another one I do, which Danielle, my partner, was talking about the other week, like it was some new revelation, but I've been doing it for years and I don't think she even noticed. I like cleaning like our stainless steel sink and the microwave with a lemon.
Okay.
And apparently that's now a thing.
That's an old school thing.
But there's been some trend with some cleaner woman on social media, some influencer, I can't remember what her name is, but almost like it's like some new revelation. But I've always preferred cleaning with a lemon. Well, that sounds, it sounds
nice
strange,
smell.
But I like it. Now, my favourite one. Now, I hate birthday cards and Christmas cards and all that sort of stuff. Don't get me started, George. I could go on for hours about it. But one that's quite good and I've definitely been doing in the last couple of years is gift wrap. It's just a plain brown gift wrap, because you can't recycle a lot of the other gift wraps because they've got glitter on or they've got bits and pieces on that are just not good for the environment. You can actually just make your own, you know, little gift wrap. With some brown paper, and
looks
you can
really
use a stamp.
Classy, I think, yeah, with a bit of ribbon.
Exactly, yeah, and that sounds, it might sound daft. It might think, well, that's not going to save me much money, or, you know, that's not going to save the environment, but it all adds up.
Yeah.
And there's some of my favourite things that are on that list.
Oh, I like it. Simon?
Yes, I would agree with some of Lee's, actually. I'm not a big fan of wrapping paper, and the whole food waste thing is definitely an issue. One of the ones I'm probably unlikely to be doing is going veggie one day a week, I would say.
I tried veganism for 6 months.
Yeah?
Yeah, not a fan of that.
I was pretty
much veggie anyway, but veganism was just a massive step too far for me.
I'm a fairly committed carnivore.
Yeah.
Recycling print cartridges. The home printer industry is just evil. Literally evil. It is based on the idea that they flog you the printer cheap and then they just charge you loads of money for the cartridges. And those cartridges are very environmentally unfriendly. Obviously, the printers, in fact, some of them have a sneaky little shelf life built into them. My wife recently found out that her printer just stopped working. Because there's something built into it, which means that effectively, after a certain number of prints, it announces one part of it is past its date of use and you just can't replace it. It's too expensive to replace. It's cheaper to replace the printer. So obviously, people repeatedly replacing cheap printers is not good for the environment.
But that's something you've just touched on there in terms of tech generally. This throwaway culture that we have, where it is actually cheaper to buy something again, I don't know, maybe a mobile phone or not, but you know, lots of technology now, it is just cheaper just to chuck it and buy another one.
It is, and I'd like to think that I'm doing my bit for the environment by the fact that me and my family have a second-hand toaster that we were given by my wife's sister. It's a 4-slice toaster. It takes up quite a lot of room on the side. Only 2 slices of it have ever worked in our ownership, and yet we're still using it 3 years later. But I picked a couple out myself, and these are places where I think people can make a big change. Might be harder in some instances than others, but these are probably 3 I think are worth thinking about. The first one, and this is easy, dead easy, green energy.
Mm-hmm.
Switch to green energy. It costs you a tiny bit more. However, if you have 100% renewable energy, you are part of a movement that's making a big difference. Coal-fired power stations are a major, major, major contributor to carbon emissions, and every person who switches to 100% renewable energy pushes that further and further away and makes a really big difference. I think I quoted a stat recently, which is it's something like one coal-fired power station is worth something like 600 million transatlantic flights a year.
Wow.
So really big difference. Electric cars. Now, obviously, there's a big push here. Mm-hmm. Things are going to start to change. I think the real issue is that actually a lot of people don't actually want to buy a new car. And previously, electric cars new have been more expensive. And if you want a family one, then you have to go up the scale. For example, whilst a Renault Zoe is relatively expensive, that's a little run around. A Tesla, which is a big family-sized car, or a Jaguar I-Pace, is very expensive. You're talking £60,000 cars there. So second-hand cars are the key here. Are you brave enough to take the plunge on a second-hand electric car? Don't know. Lots of people are very worried about that. They worry about the batteries. They worry about the technology. They worry about just cars, electric cars getting substantially better. Maybe the government needs to kind of step in and nudge people in the right direction to help them with second-hand cars. But also a lot of people think, well, I would like a second-hand electric car, so I only buy second-hand cars, never buy brand new cars. But when we brought a brand new family car, you know, I couldn't afford a second-hand Tesla. But maybe think about, where do you do your miles? Are a lot of your miles racked up just with runabouts locally? Are the big family trips you do, could you buy a cheap electric Renault Zoe, Nissan Leaf, second-hand, pick one up for $6,000 or $7,000 as the car that you use for driving around town, that kind of thing. And then you just have a bigger family car that you use for the long trips, for the going to visit family at the weekends or going away and things like that. And most people think, oh, the range, though, just, you know, it runs out of battery. Most people don't do that many miles a week. Most people could probably do it on one charge. So maybe look into that. And then flights as well. We've been criticised a lot for the amount that we fly. I find it very confusing when we get told that we need to be more environmentally friendly by the government and authorities, yet at the same time they are backing widespread airport expansion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get that. I don't really get how the ULEZ is coming into London for air quality and going to be taken all the way out to the North and South Circular, yet we're backing the massive expansion of Heathrow for people who aren't even actually going to enter this country. We're talking about it as a hub airport. So just for people flying in, stopping on the ground and then flying off somewhere else, airport expansion, that makes flights cheaper. Because flights are so cheap, we fly lots more than we used to. Think about, do you really need to fly? Could you take the train? Can you get the Eurostar out of the country and then link up to Europe's vastly better and vastly cheaper train service than we have? And if you think, oh, well, yeah, but I'm going to need a car to get around while I'm on holiday, well, maybe you could get the train to somewhere and then hire a car when you get there. That is what my wife's sister and her husband and the kids did last year. They got the train all the way down to Marseille and then hired a car for the holiday. Wasn't any more expensive than flying and hiring a car. Was better for the environment. And they said, actually, a much nicer experience and more fun than flying. And finally, as you said earlier, buy less stuff. And when you do buy stuff, make it count, make it last.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about cars and travel and pleasurable experiences, because you also have an article on your website looking at exactly that, the pleasurable experience of driving a car. And what might surprise people, if you've been in the back of an Uber, generally, that's quite a pleasurable experience, I'm not going to lie, but they tend to be Toyota Priuses. But apparently that's come pretty high on a list of the most satisfying cars to drive. That is a bit of a surprise, Lee.
I don't know if it's a surprise, Georgie, per se.
Of all the cars?
So this survey was of new cars that were under 24 months old. And actually, the car that was bottom, which is the Astra, still had an 89% satisfaction rating. And
Based on what are we satisfied
so
with?
So there's 31 areas from boot space, in-car technology, fuel economy, handling, reliability. So all sorts of factors. But what it actually does highlight, the survey, is that most people are very satisfied with their new car purchases, because the top car, as you mentioned there, is the Prius at 93.2%. And then I'm saying bottom, at 75th place, Astra, 89%, is actually only a 4% difference, which is not really too big. So, you know, there's a lot of people that are happy with their cars, and it's very sort of a lot of cars that are kind of in the same zone. But yeah, people are happy with the Priuses, and usually a good indicator of a good car that's going to, you know, be reliable, it's going to do the job well, are when taxi drivers are using that vehicle. It's always a good indication of something that's a quite solid and reliable drive. And the Prius is kind of like the original hybrid. You know, it's the one that's...
What's a hybrid for anyone who's not really sure?
So it's a combo of petrol and electric.
It's better than petrol, but not quite...
Yeah, well, it depends.
As good as electric, or...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's meant to combine the best elements of both. So I actually test drove a Mitsubishi PEV, which was a similar concept. And it's quite interesting because it motors into electric when it feels like it needs to or can at the best. It kind of knows, the technology kind of knows when best to use what. Interestingly, in this survey, six of the top 10 were either hybrid, plug-in hybrid, or full-on electric. So that's six out of the top 10 cars of this survey in which people were most satisfied, which indicates that people are buying these cars and are happy with them and are happy that they've made that purchase and happy perhaps that they feel like they're doing something that's a little bit better for the environment. The Prius is a really solid eco-friendly car, and it's, you know, one of the global bestsellers, and people clearly like buying them. For £24,000 for a new car, it's, you know, it's not too bad for the technology. Of course, some people might disagree and might not have a budget that's high. I think what a lot of people are put off from buying a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid or a full electric is they do worry that the technology is going to improve substantially, I would suggest, within the next 5 years, especially as more companies push towards, you know, Volvo are talking about full electric cars, and that's all they're going to sell from 5 years' time. So, you know, there's going to be lots of strides and technology research and development into this area. And I think people are worried about getting involved, getting one of these, and then the technology getting much better, range is becoming better. That's always the range anxiety is always a big one for people, of course.
Essentially, how far you can go and what you're charging.
Exactly. I mean,
charging's another one, though, as well, isn't it?
Charge points, yeah, and they're quite unsightly, and, you know, as more people get plug-in cars, if you were at a service station, for example, people fighting and clamoring over getting a charge unit. Of course, a Prius, you know, is a combo of petrol and electric, so you don't have that range anxiety. But I think the interesting line from this survey is the fact that, you know, more than half of the top 10 are plug-in hybrids or full electric. So I think that more and more people will be tempted in the next few years.
Are they happy or are they just smug?
Yeah. I did wonder that.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Right, let's change tack a little bit, because as figures show, more of us are starting our own business. And so this next question will be one that perhaps many people are asking. In your Money Pit Stop series, you get an investing expert to give your readers a free portfolio makeover. And in this week, you spoke to Jed and Joe from York. They're both in their 40s. They've owned their own welding company for 9 years. The issue is neither have pensions. They do, however, have savings, a mortgage-free home, and a fair whack in their business account. So what to do and where to invest so that they can retire at 65. Simon?
Well, it's worth noting that if you are in your 40s and you don't have a pension, then you do need to act. However, if you are in your 40s and you're in the position that this couple are in, then you're in a decent position in which to act. So we are starting from a point where both of them, you know, fortunately do have the opportunity to be saving. The advice is from Joe Roxburgh, Chartered Financial Planner, advisor, Ascot Lloyd. He said, Jed and Joe have already made some prudent decisions about how to invest their cash, and now the main choices for them are around how to invest their SIP money optimally. They're right to avoid the buy-to-let property market. This is something they've been considering because he says, as a speculative investment, the punitive tax charges, illiquidity, so it's hard to buy and sell properties, and lack of diversification make this a rather unappealing way to meet their goals, especially if they don't consider themselves property experts. It's worth noting that many financial advisors are not big fans of buy-to-let. Many Britons are fans of buy-to-let. So horses for courses. But he said a SIP, on the other hand, can be very tax efficient. So, for example, the key difference here is that if you want to buy a buy-to-let property, the government will take money off you in the form of stamp duty to the tune of whatever stamp duty rate you'd be paying plus 3%. Mm-hmm. That means that if you buy a £200,000 property, you can end up paying out more than £10,000 in tax just to buy that property. On the other hand, if you pay some money into a pension, the government will give you a tax boost on it, a tax relief boost on it. So you will get a 25% uplift to give you automatic basic rate tax relief. And then, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can claim back the extra tax. So there's a really good point here in that whilst if you put your money into a buy-to-let, you'll have money taken off you by the government in the form of tax. If you put your money into a pension, you'll have money given back to you, returning to the tax that you've already paid. Then you can think about investing for the long term. And then, so the question here is, how would they invest? They've both described themselves as medium risk. Medium risk to many people means different things, but it generally means that you are wanting good growth, but you're slightly concerned about one day opening up your investment account and finding that you have less than you put in. So that means that you need to be looking for funds that will offer some kind of decent growth, investing in shares, but also the protection of bonds, of diversification into things like commercial property as well. And also you need to be thinking with a long time horizon. They've got a 20-year time horizon. That should allow them to consider most investment opportunities as suitable for them and to ride out any volatility. And what is likely to happen, as we repeatedly say here, is at some point in about 20 years' time, they'll sit down and they'll thank their lucky stars that they bothered to do something about this when they were in their mid-40s rather than procrastinating and not doing anything.
I'm sure they will. Good advice there. Simon, thank you very much. Talking of pensions, we're going to return to the somewhat baffling issue of state pension top-ups. Now, you have the case of a saver who tried to fill the gaps in his national insurance record to the tune of $2,500. It counted, Lee, towards his state pension. Great. Mm-hmm. But it didn't actually improve it. Not so great. And so what the heck was the point, you ask?
This story, honestly, we've been reporting on this. Our reporter, Tanya Jeffries, has been reporting on this for the last couple of years. And it's just such a confusing, chaotic system for people. So what's happening is that, the taxman's writing to people saying they've got gaps in their national insurance and they can plug the gap by, putting payments in there so then they get a full state pension. But then what's happening is people are taking the advice from the taxman and doing it, and then it's not giving them any kind of uplift whatsoever. And last year, what happened, it all came to a boil when we had a lot of case studies come in. We did a joint couple of stories with our sister title, Money Mail, in which we had loads of case studies of people that this had happened to. And they were dragging their heels about refunding people that had paid. So, for example, in this case, £2,500, they were dragging their heels. Have you ever tried to get through to the tax man and try to, and if you're trying to get money from them, have you ever tried to get through and get issues resolved?
Lee.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of those things in which people are getting sent quite contradictory advice. So they're getting letters, they're making these voluntary payments to plug shortfalls, and then it actually turns out that they're doing absolutely nothing for their state pension. And what the HMRC are saying is that people should be contacting the Future Pensions Centre. So they've got a telephone number in our story, and they should be taking advice, but the advice can take up to 21 days to arrive. And who knows if they're going to be getting the advice. It all feels like such a waste of everyone's time.
Oh, yeah.
I do not understand why people are getting written to. Is it some sort of computer algorithm somewhere that's just punting these letters out to people, giving them incorrect advice, telling them to plug these shortfalls when it's going to make absolutely zero difference to their monthly state pension?
Oh. I think you're probably right. Like, I don't have this particular case in terms of state pension top-up. What I did have was that they charged me for not filing a tax return when I didn't need to, right? And I told them very clearly I don't need to do it. But I think it was obviously, hang on, she did it the year before. Let's just automatically send her a £100 fine. It took me... I made a whole batch of brownies before I actually finally got through to someone, right? And then the real kicker of that, the brownies were all right, I'm not going to lie. The real kicker at the end of that was, oh, well, sometimes it takes a month to refund. You need to call us back tomorrow. No!
That's the thing. And actually, it's such a slow system. And for a lot of people waiting, weeks for these types of things to happen, it could... Yeah. It plays on your mind and it affects your life. And I just feel like it's understaffed and it's never properly... There just always seems to be issues. And why is it the case that we're all facing these issues all the time? Why is it the case that we put a load of case studies and readers over to HMRC last year in which they're having exactly the same problems? Wouldn't someone just look at that and go, you know what, that is bonkers. Why are we doing that? Why is there not a better system to sort this out? I think that's the frustration, Georgie. And it's not just with HMRC, it's with every financial firm that we ever deal with, in which we give plenty of time to rectify issues, we point out problems, And then things aren't resolved and sorted out in a timely fashion, and it's just sort of bang your head against the brick wall type scenarios. And I know that Tanya was saying to me this morning that a number of people have written in again with the same problem again.
So we're
no closer
to resolving this issue.
Doesn't appear to be any kind of resolution
well,
to this,
Georgie. Keep going, Tanya. Keep going.
Keep going, and we're going to get some more answers as to what on earth is going on. And if you have been affected, email editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
I'm going to say power in numbers as well.
Exactly.
Right, finally, just how far above a speed limit can you go in your area before the cameras get you? Now, we ask this not because we're naughty drivers. No, we're not trying to push the limits here. But because there's a fair degree of discrepancy, I suggest, across forces. You have a new investigation by Auto Express. Tell us a little bit more about what was found.
Well, actually, Georgie, this is a really quite interesting story. So 45 police forces were contacted, 33 replied for a Freedom of Information request. And in most cases, what they're saying is that you can go 10% over the speed limit plus 2 miles an hour.
I always thought that was the case. And then someone said, no way, you can't do anything.
It's not a blanket rule. So some police forces don't implement that. It's actually less generous than that. And I would strongly advise that you don't test that to the limit. Don't start thinking that you can, you know, go on a 30 and then go 35 and you'll be all right, because it's just about in the limit. So that would mean on a 30 you could do 35 and get away with it, allegedly. But I would not, honestly. I just, what's the point of pushing that? What I actually found really interesting about this, and I was speaking to Rob, our motoring editor, this morning about this, because I really didn't know about this. So your car speedometer is not actually very accurate. I never really knew this. So if your car speedometer says you're going 30 miles an hour, the chances are you're probably more likely to be going 27, 28 or 29 miles an hour. They under egg it a little bit. And it's the same. So they had a list of cars and it showed what the speedometer, the actual speed was. So if you thought you're going 30, most of them are about 27, 28. You think you're going 50, or in most cases it says you're going to be going 47, and you think you're going 70, in most cases you're going 67. I found that really interesting. I had no idea about that. Basically, a speedometer can be 10% under plus 6.25 mile an hour. So that means, actually, if you think you're going 50, you could potentially be going 40. I think it's really fascinating. Honestly, maybe I'm oblivious. I'm sure Simon will tell me otherwise if this is a very common, widely known thing, but I genuinely had no idea.
But there is also, I mean, with everything, anybody who's done a, you know, physics GCSE knows that there's a degree of grace, should we put it this way, a degree of margin of error, I think they call it, Simon, is that fair?
Yes, and it's quite important, obviously. Modern day cars will have a more electronic speedometer system, but in older cars, the speedometer is essentially really quite basic, and you have a speedo cable, which basically will spin on the car as the car moves. In the simplest way, this is like very oversimplifying it, it turns cable. Turning the cable creates electromagnetic force that is then transferred into a reading of how fast the car's going. And my speedometer cable on my car snapped, so my speedometer stopped working, which also meant the odometer showing how many miles you were doing stopped working as well. And so I had to get a new speedo cable. It's an old car. You couldn't order the speedo cable from Peugeot in this country anymore, so it had to be ordered from France. So I had a car with no speedometer for a while. And you wouldn't believe how difficult it is to drive a car with no speedo.
Surely that's illegal.
No, it's not, because I was in the process of replacing the cable and I couldn't replace the cable. And driving without a working
speedometer,
as far as I'm aware, driving without a working speedometer is not illegal. Speeding is illegal.
That's
a
good point.
So as long as you're not speeding, then it's fine. But you've got to judge it on how fast the traffic around you is going, which is quite difficult because they might be speeding or there might not be any traffic around you. Or you have to judge it on the revs of the car in certain gears. But that does rely on you knowing how fast you are likely to be going at a certain rev level in a certain gear, which, you know, even with a car you know well, it's quite difficult to do. What I actually did was I limited the amount of driving that I did in the car.
Probably a good idea.
To the bare minimum.
Yeah. We don't recommend this.
But a lot of this came, I think this actually Auto Express looked into this off the back of something that we also looked in a while back, which was this rumour that went around social media and the internet that claimed to be from a cabbie who said that they'd been sent something by Transport for London, or claimed to be from someone whose mate was a cabbie who'd been sent something by Transport for London, warning them that the automatic speed cameras that are in place on the motorway, on the M1, were now set to 70 miles an hour, and if you went even 1 mile an hour above it, you would be done for speeding. Of course, like many things that goes around on the internet, this turned out to be not true. Transport for London said they had not sent anything out. The police forces involved with the speed cameras would not confirm at what level that they were set or whether this was true or not, but we could tell that it wasn't true. But I as Lee said, I wouldn't be putting a huge amount of faith in the on the basis that you can do plus 10% plus 2 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Because you won't get off a speeding ticket by saying, yeah, but I read this story that said in most places you could do plus 10% plus 2 miles an hour. So that's why I was doing 46 in a 40 zone.
No, we don't recommend it. And we're not talking about this story because we're trying to push this to the limit. But you did get a varied response. What were some of the responses? Like, where in the country can you perhaps do that? The police told you that you can do that. And where are they perhaps a bit stricter?
So I have the table here. Avon and Somerset, 10% plus 2 miles an hour. Bedfordshire, would not reveal threshold. Cambridgeshire, would not reveal threshold. Cheshire, Cleveland, Derbyshire, Devon and Cornwall, Durham, 10% plus 2 miles an hour. Essex, would not, don't use a standard threshold. I think that's just a won't reveal threshold, but I just gave a different answer. Greater
races.
Manchester, would not reveal threshold. Gwent, Hampshire, 10% plus 2. Hertfordshire, would not reveal. Kent, Lancashire, Leicestershire, Merseyside, Metropolitan Police, TfL. Oh, no, hang on a minute. I've got an outlier here. So I've got Kent, 10% plus 2, then Lancashire, 10% plus 3, ooh, Leicestershire, 10% plus 2, Merseyside, 10% plus 2, Metropolitan Police, TfL, 10% plus 3, and then back to a load of 10% plus 2s, and then some would not reveal thresholds. Overwhelmingly, it is 10% plus 2. I think you can probably work on the basis that the ones that say they won't reveal a threshold are also working to 10% plus 2. But don't try and get off a speeding ticket on the basis that some bloke on a podcast who'd read a story said that usually it's 10% plus 2.
Exactly. Don't do that. And don't speed, people. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you'd like to get in contact with us, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got something you want us to investigate. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find the podcast archive and join in the conversation in reader comments, where you can tell us about how you were unfairly treated to a speeding ticket at less than the speed limit plus 10% and 2 miles an hour.
Exactly. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.